from WJFM.
Radio Catskill, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Sullivan County government approves a 2% tax hike and bets on ambitious revenue projections. We'll hear from Sullivan County legislators, some who say it was one of the hardest budgets they've ever worked on. We'll also get reaction from Dan Hoost, communications director from Sullivan County government. From the Overlook, editor-in-chief Noah Eckstein joins us to discuss a fatal rescue on Panther Mountain that's sparking new calls for hiker education, and a look back at 2025's biggest stories from the Overlook, including their founding just in February. The latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. And this Sunday, the year's shortest day is marked with music. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks with guitarist and songwriter Hiroya Sukumoto ahead of the winter solstice matinee. That's after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he's leaving the possibility of war with Venezuela on the table. That's according to an interview he gave to NBC News published this morning. Trump's also threatening to seize more oil tankers near Venezuelan waters, just as the U.S. did last week. Trump's actions involving Venezuela are the latest examples of his aggressive use of American power abroad. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports on how he's reshaping U.S. foreign policy using his America First lens.
Since taking office, President Trump's used tariffs as a weapon against allies, declared war on drug cartels, and secured the release of hostages from Gaza. Lori Esposito Murray is a veteran in diplomatic circles. She says the expectations at the beginning of the administration that Trump would isolate the U.S. were clearly wrong.
I would say that the main goal of America First and the president's foreign policy is to not to withdraw, but to engage, to reshape the world order, fundamentally reshape the global trade and financial systems to U.S. preferences.
Murray says Trump is using both economic and military power to pursue U.S. interests, albeit in targeted ways. She points to the strikes on Iran and the military buildup outside of Venezuela. Franco Ordonez, NPR News. The White House.
European Union leaders have agreed to give Ukraine a multi-billion-dollar loan with no interest. This will help Ukraine pay for defense equipment as it fights Russia's invasion. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his annual news conference today. He insists Russia will make big military gains in Ukraine this coming year. Putin is also dismissing claims that Russia could attack elsewhere in Europe. He's heard here speaking through an interpreter.
This is done based on the political reasons, and this is done to create the image of an enemy. They are creating an image of an enemy, and they're making Russia the enemy.
That audio is courtesy of the BBC. Stocks opened higher this morning as TikTok signs a deal that will allow the social media platform to continue operating in the U.S. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 275 points in early trading.
TikTok's agreed to create a new U.S. unit under largely domestic control. Oracle, Silver Lake, and Abu Dhabi-based MGX are among the primary stakeholders in the venture. TikTok's Chinese parent company had been ordered to sell or cease operations in the U.S. News of the deal pushed Oracle's stock higher. Sales of existing homes were up last month compared to the previous month, but down from this time last year. The National Association of Realtors says the average selling price in November rose to just over $409,000. Central banks around the world have been cutting interest rates, but Japan's central bank raised its benchmark rate today by a quarter point. Stocks in Tokyo and elsewhere in Asia were mostly higher overnight. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Today's the deadline for the Justice Department to release all its case files on late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Last month, President Trump signed a law ordering their release. That includes computer and physical evidence from the FBI, grand jury testimony, and other information already published. But the Justice Department can redact some material to protect victims' identity or follow certain confidentiality rules. A new report finds children and teenagers are turning to AI chatbots for companionship, emotional support, and role-playing. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has more on the study from the digital security company, Aura.
When kids use artificial intelligence tools, 42% of the time it's for companionship, where kids engage with a chatbot for an ongoing conversation. And frequently, nearly 40% of the time, those conversations involve violent role-playing. Scott Collins is chief medical officer at Aura.
It is role-play that is interaction about harming somebody else, physically hurting them, torturing them, fighting them. And a lot of it gets pretty graphic.
These conversations also tend to be longer, he says, compared to when they use AI for help with homework. Among 13 to 17-year-olds, kids who spend more time online are also more stressed out by their digital lives. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Heavy rain has moved into Northern California this morning. Weather forecasters say there's a risk of flash flooding, especially in urban areas, through tomorrow. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
This is a special edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Erin Shear with Eating Upstate, where I interview...
All right, we've got some gremlins in our board here. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's not the holiday just yet, so we're still live. After weeks of back and forth amongst lawmakers and two public hearings pushing back on a proposed tax hike, Sullivan County legislators have approved its 2026 county budget. Yesterday, legislators voted 5-3 to adopt a spending plan that raises property taxes by 2% and relies on some ambitious revenue projections. We'll get some live reaction from Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. But first, Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar shares this update.
After nearly 2 hours of floor debate, Sullivan County legislators adopted an amended $305.7 million budget for 2026. That includes a property tax increase of 2%, far below the proposed 9.1% tax increase the county originally put forward back in October.
Nadia Rice.
Yes.
Joe Perillo. On the budget.
I am a no, and going forward for next year's
Roberts rules, it's just a vote.
Thank you.
Matt McPhillips.
Yes.
Brian McPhillips.
Yes.
Nick Salamone.
No.
Kat Scott.
Yes.
Louis Alvarez.
Yes.
Terry Bernardo.
No.
Passes.
6-3.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Good job, guys.
Five,
good job.
Three.
Good
5,
job.
3.
The budget increases the county's anticipated revenue in several categories, including more airport fuel, cannabis sales, and EMS billing revenue. The budget does not include any staff layoffs. Legislature Chair and District 2 Legislator Nadia Raj told Radio Catskill that landing on the tax levy figure was a very difficult decision for legislators to agree on.
Originally, it was 15%, then it went down to 9%, then there was some error that was seen, then it went down to 7%. People were not happy. You were here at the last meeting. People were not happy with that percentage increase. So some of us, the Democrats, we caucused and decided that we need to rein it in and bring it down even lower to make the public happier. This may not bode well with us in the future.
The 9.1% property tax increase that was originally proposed was because of the sales tax decrease. How does that gap get filled now?
Wishful thinking. We're hoping that we are hoping that in the future, the sales tax revenue decline will revert back to being higher. We don't know. If it stays status quo the way it is, if it's stable the way it is, we may be looking at some difficult times in the future.
Sullivan County Manager Joshua Potosik has said that the original 9.1% property tax increase was needed to make up for the county's anticipated $5 million sales tax decrease. District 7 legislator Joseph Perillo voted against the budget. He says the budget falsely inflates projected revenues.
These amendments are reckless. It's going to be putting the county next year in a worse position than we are today.
Legislators Terry Blosser Bernardo and Nicholas Salamon also voted against the budget. Just before the vote, several last-minute resolutions were passed by the legislative body. For instance, lawmakers voted 4-3 to adjust and increase the Sullivan County Sheriff's salary to $145,000. That left legislators scrambling to rework the numbers on the fly. Legislator Brian McPhillips, who chairs the Budget and Management Committee, voted in favor of the budget, but with extreme caution.
I am very reluctant on any additional positions being filled. I'm going to be very reluctant on approving any type of work.
McPhillips described the budget as a, quote, status quo budget that he does not believe will move the county forward. In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And joining us live, as he does every Friday, Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the budget has passed, you know, put that to bed. But I guess some folks maybe have some questions lingering a bit, at least I do, about how do you go from a 9% proposed tax increase to just a 2% tax increase? How did that happen? Can you kind of give us explain some of the things that happened? Were services cut? Were, you know, other things done creatively, so to speak?
No services are being cut, to my knowledge. There is a list of amendments, actually, that should be now part of the budget agenda packet online, available where you go to watch the meeting. And that was this amendments, that was what legislators decided over the course of a flurry of activity over the past week, really, to see if they could get the proposed tax increase down farther. My boss, the county manager, Josh Potosik, proposed a 9.1% tax increase budget because he felt that that was the fiscally responsible thing to do, that balanced the needs of the people that we serve with the needs of the people who pay for that. And sometimes it's one and the same, sometimes it's one and the other, but it's always that. And Josh himself is a taxpayer. He's got a family with children and stuff. He lives up in the Livingston Manor area. He knows that he's going to have to pay this as well. So this is not handled lightly. And he and I had talked about it months ago when I heard that it was going towards that. And of course, from a public relations perspective, as I said to you before, the lower the tax increase, the happier I am, because the happier the taxpayers are. But the idea of a tax increase, I learned this by serving on nonprofit boards that were taxing, like the library board. While it sounds wonderful to do a no tax increase or a reduced tax increase, you can often be setting yourself up for a much higher tax increase in the next year or two because you haven't really planned appropriately for the ever-increasing costs. Because costs never go down. We know. Yeah. The costs always go up. So that's the concern here. And I think you heard that in the report. Some of the legislators are saying, too, that this is anticipating higher revenues than maybe we realistically are going to see. This is using fund balance, which are surplus funds that you really want to only trot out when you absolutely have to. Where in this case, actually, some fund balance was used to come down from a 15% tax increase that mm-hmm. was originally being considered to the 9.1. So there are concern by some legislators that in the next year or two that the financial situation will be even tougher and will have less cushion to deal with as we're going forward. That said, I am personally thrilled that it's a 2% tax increase. Like I said, makes it easier to talk to taxpayers about it. I know how much they struggle, and that should never be minimized.
Right. I mean, I'm a taxpayer in Sullivan County, so mm-hmm. okay, I'm glad that for you have that me look personally, the 2%. But I also am looking at this in terms of what we've talked about over the course of the last few weeks here, ever since the proposal was made, that, you know, there is a realistic reason why 9% was proposed. Mm-hmm. There's a $5 million or more deficit when it comes to sales tax. And, you know, as Legislative Chair Nadia Reich said, in the short term, she's pleased to figure out a way to stay beneath the tax cap with just a 2% increase. But in the long term, she says it will be challenging. And so that kind of leads into what you're saying here. You know, how much risk is there in this just minimal increase for
there
next
is risk.
Year?
I can't say there isn't. I think Nadia herself said it on Kim's story there, that there is risk that it's going to be some challenging years ahead. Our county manager, Josh, and our Office of Management and Budget, which is run by our commissioner, Anna Marie Novello, and her team, worked very hard to put that proposed budget together. They did not just throw it out there, as some people are accusing, to pad people's salaries or to add things that were unnecessary. This is what they felt as taxpayers themselves, but also financial professionals, that this is what was required and necessary. Some legislators, even legislators like Brian McPhillips, who passed the budget, still felt like the 9.1% was the better alternative in terms of operations and providing services, but opted to go for the 2%. And I think, you know, most legislators would say that it's going to be tricky moving forward to make sure that we are balancing, as this budget attempts to, the needs of the taxpayers with the needs of the people we serve, which, like I said, is one and the same at times. But I also heard from, like, Brian, I think, said it, and I think Legislator Scott said it as well in the press release I put out, they are going to have to look very critically at any unbudgeted expense that's requested in this next year. And I'm not even sure if any of them are going to vote for that or not. I think they're going to be saying, unless this is absolutely an emergency situation, I just don't see where we can spend the money on that. That's what I've been told by some of the legislators.
It seems as if a public reaction in those public hearings played a factor in the decision-making,
certainly did.
Is encouraging for, you know, getting your voice heard.
I am always about people interact with your legislature. Too often we have a dedicated group, but a small group of people who constantly come. Legislators are hungry to hear from the larger group of constituents. Doesn't have to be at the meetings, but those public hearings, that's what it's for. And I'll tell you what, those public hearings showed you that coming out and saying how you feel about something to legislators can move the needle.
We're heading into a year where there is still some uncertainty at the state and federal level because of funding questions. How much of a concern is that for legislators, do you think, when we're talking about unbudgeted expenses? We still don't know maybe what's going to be happening.
It is a huge concern, not just for legislators, but for all of county administration, because the idea is that the state provides a lot of these funding for a lot of these mandated services, but they get funding from the federal government, which has been taking back funding in different areas. We've talked about that over the past few months. So if the state doesn't have the money from the federal government, they don't have the money to give to counties and other municipalities that they fund. And then the county has to either figure out how to do it with their own money, which we've done with Sullivan Volunteers once the RSVP program disappeared at the federal level, or you just stop offering that service, which we, for example, with the HEAP, we couldn't offer that for a while because there was no money coming in for HEAP. Thankfully, that changed and we now can offer it. But this is not the last time that I think we're going to face these kinds of potential crises.
One other thing on the budget, as we mentioned, there is a projected $5.5 million decrease in sales tax revenue for this year. But in this budget, the legislators put in an increase of about $2.5 million in sales tax projected
in anticipated,
sales tax revenue for next year. What data did they base this on?
I think legislator Brian McPhillips spoke to that yesterday. I encourage people to watch the video because it was an interesting conversation. He was talking about historically that that's not out of the realm of possibility. It is not the projection that the Office of Management and Budget and the County Manager's Office originally came to, but legislators decided, or at least majority of them did, that this is an entirely feasible number that we could hit. Of course, if we don't, as some of the other legislators said, then there could be issues there. But there is also still some fund balance and contingency funds left. So I would say that if we don't hit the projected revenues this year, we'll still be able to fund everything we need to do in 2026. But that will, of course, make it even more difficult to figure out a 2027 budget.
And one of the legislators referred to it as a quote status quo budget. Do you know what he meant by that? I think that was
Brian McPhillips said
sorry.
That.
Yeah.
He called it a status quo budget. Even though he was voting for it, he preferred the 9.1% tax increase. Let's go back to what I said earlier, where he felt that this doesn't really move the county forward, that it just sort of keeps us swimming in place, that a tax increase was necessary to really squeeze out the best, maximize, I think is what he said, the benefits for taxpayers. Whether taxpayers agree with that or not is sort of a moot point now, but that is really what he felt as a financial guy. He chairs our Management and Budget Committee. He meets regularly with our Office of Management and Budget. He understood, like I said, how hard our Office of Management and Budget crew worked to create what they felt was a fiscally responsible budget.
Some people refer to swimming in place also as treading water.
Yes. Or status quo.
Okay. We're spending a lot of time on budget here. Obviously, there's more at the website. It's all public record. You give me a whole list of what's been included
and that's
here.
In the agenda that's packet. All in there. The adopted budget will be probably posted in the next couple of weeks just because we've got to redo all the numbers in there. We were doing the numbers on the fly yesterday. Now we've got to actually put them into a official document. So be patient with us on that. But if you watch the meeting from yesterday and you look at the documents that are attached to that meeting on our website, you will see what you need to know about what happened and why.
Okay. We've got just about 5 minutes left today because we're trying to squeeze a few other things in later.
Sure.
So I want to make sure we get to some of the other highlights for you that you want to make sure folks understand. The bonding pushed off for the new court facility. This was a state.
And other bonding as well was affected that wasn't related. But the state has told us that we are going to need to expand the court offices. Now, the question is, do we build a new building? Do we add onto the existing courthouse on the backside where we would have to tear down the jail? Some legislators are thinking, yes, let's do that. Some others are saying, let's sell the jail and the patrol building and build a new court someplace else. That all remains to be determined. And the big thing, though, on that is the Office of Court Administration has yet to come back with us with the full list of requirements that they want, which would allow us to design and plan for this. So until we know that, legislators decided, let's hold off on bonding pretty much anything that we have to, except I think they're going to do like roads. They're going to bond roads. But we need to know more information from the state, because otherwise, what are we bonding? So, right.
Lexington Center for Recovery is bringing inpatient drug treatment back to Sullivan County,
yes,
which is a good news.
This is wonderful news because we have not had this for a while, and it's coming to what most people remember as the skilled nursing unit at Garnet Health Catskills campus in Harris. They're renovating it so that we could have inpatient, that means residential, substance use treatment facility with 47 residential and detox beds. Those renovations are probably going to be complete before we get to the end of this year. We expect it to open in the first quarter of 2026. Absolutely essential service to keep people who are going through these difficult situations in their home community.
And Oxford House just opened their third sober living home in the community.
Yeah, this is something too. This comes from our Commissioner of Health and Human Services, John Little. He was putting this out. It reflects the continued need for and success of peer-supported recovery housing and the county's ongoing commitment, not just Oxford House's, to expanding safe and sober living options. What Oxford House does, it provides a democratically run, self-supporting environment where residents actually support one another in maintaining their sobriety, building accountability, and establishing long-term stability in recovery. This is the third of these houses in the county. This is wonderful things that we're offering to people who are in desperate need and suffering from addiction here in our community.
Wanted to save a little time for some good news from some of the employees at Sullivan County Government. They honored the Employee of the Year. Who was that?
The Employee of the Year.
Not
was
you?
Not me, no. Jennifer Perito, she works in our grants administration. She's basically second in charge there. She has been with us for several years now. I can't remember how many, but she is just a pleasure to deal with and so knowledgeable, not just about grants for municipalities, but beyond that. She's helped other communities or other organizations in Sullivan County connect with grants. She may not be able to write them or anything. She does a lot of it for in-house for the county, but she is a tremendous resource and just a wonderful person to deal with. And according to her boss, our grants administrator, Art Hussey, her bacon could, and her skills could end up leading to world peace, he thinks.
Jennifer will be calling you soon. The holiday door decor winner was announced. Who was that?
That was our Division of Community Resources, Office for the Aging, Youth Bureau, Nutrition. They are in the government center, and they had a wonderful holiday scene where their faces were pasted on the faces of elves and Santa and everything. So people just fell in love with that when we put it out there on Facebook. They got the most likes. They were very closely followed by Public Health's billing department, which also was very creative. Everybody was. It put everybody in the holiday spirit. I'm always amazed to see how much engagement. We had 600 people at least get involved in voting on this. And so they got a nice gift basket yesterday.
And want to mention Nancy Buck Bennett.
Yeah.
Bidding farewell. She's retiring.
Our county treasurer, Nancy Buck, she has been with us for around 2 decades or more. Actually, no, 25 years is what she said. And she gave a very emotional, tearful farewell that a lot of people got emotional about, too, listening to it at legislative meeting yesterday. I've posted the video on our social media where I took an actual video separate from the cameras in the room that typically record that meeting. We wish her well. She retires on December 31st to be replaced by her deputy county treasurer, Kathleen Lara, who is also a joy to work with.
Always good to recognize the folks who are keeping the government running. They're real people there doing that. Always nice to acknowledge them. And I'll acknowledge you for coming to us every Friday with an update. And no matter how positive or negative it is, you always have a smile on your face.
So I love spending time with you guys here. I really do. And I wish you nothing but the best in the holidays to come.
I want to wish you a happy, happy, and a merry, merry as well. And we are saving a little bit of time at the end of the show so we can hear from one of those student groups that are performing at the Government good. Center. We're going to hear from the Minisink Choir as we go out. They performed yesterday, and we have a little bit of that holiday music from them.
They were absolutely stunning.
Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Overlook's Editor-in-Chief, Noah Eckstein, is here with the latest on a firefighter's death during a Panther Mountain rescue and what it means for hiker safety, plus highlights from the Overlook's first year in business. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know that this month on Radio Catskill, we'll be taking a look back at the biggest local news stories of the year and showcasing the work of our amazing news team. Look, I've been here for decades, and I've never seen anything like 2025. We had more reporters making more quality news than ever before, and none of that would have been possible without you. Another thing that I never saw before this year? 24% of our budget disappearing overnight. You know, the defunding of public media was a shock. It continues to threaten the good work that we do, but it has not stopped that work. And again, that's thanks to listeners like you who stood with us. I thank you so much for that. And I ask that you stand with us again. We're trying to make our year-end goal, and right now, your donation will have triple the impact. From now until December 31st, gifts of $1,000 or less will be matched one-to-one by Newsmatch and by an anonymous longtime Radio Catskill supporter. You make a one-time donation before the end of the year, it will be tripled. Become a sound supporter, all 12 of your monthly donations will be tripled. Plus, gifts of $100 and more will also be entered for a chance to win a two-night stay at the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast. A renovated farmhouse sleeps four, located near the top of Hoke Mountain Road in the town of Walton. Go to WJFFradio.org, WJFFradio.org to give today. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Supported by listeners like you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Editor-in-Chief Noah Eckstein is with The Overlook, a community nonprofit journalism serving the Catskills. He's going to tell us this morning about the latest on a firefighter's death at Panther Mountain, rekindling some calls for hiker education in the Catskills, and a look back at some of the top stories from The Overlook in 2025. Noah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to touch first on that tragic death in Panther Mountain. It was a Phoenicia volunteer firefighter who died during a rescue attempt. Tell us a little bit about what happened and what local officials and first responders are saying about hiking safety.
Yeah, it's really a tragic week for the community in Phoenicia and Shandaken. Local officials say that the area's booming hiking traffic, especially from inexperienced visitors, is stretching volunteer fire departments pretty thin. Michael Ryan, age 61, was a volunteer firefighter in Phoenicia who responded to a hiker who was ill-prepared for the conditions of the hike, and he suffered a heart attack and did pass away. So town leaders are now pushing for clearer trailhead signage, better education, and more state support, warning that without change, another tragedy is likely. And really, a story here is that the volunteer outlets, the firefighters, the EMS, they're strained.
Yeah, yeah, it's as you mentioned in the story, it's a problem of popularity. As you said, more people out there on the trails, but they do still need to stay safe. Want to look back a little bit on some of your top stories at the Overlook, including, I think, the biggest story is you launched in February.
I know. I can't believe it's been less than a year since we've launched. We're super excited about the year ahead and increasing fundraising and our capacity. Hopefully we'll hire another full-time reporter. It was a big deal for us this past year to hire Jim Rich, who was the former editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News, who lives in Shokan, as our senior reporter. So, this nonprofit model is proving quite resilient, as you all know, and it's just exciting to provide more hyper-local coverage to Catskill communities.
Yeah, and that is your mission, to provide that hyper-local news. You're filling that gap there. And when I was looking back, you sent a newsletter out or an email out about looking back at some of the stories. And so impressive, Noah, about all the things that you guys have covered. What sort of stood out to you in terms of some of the coverage? I mean, I can mention some of them. You know, you exposed federal policy shifts reverberating in the area locally, like the SNAP freeze, USDA cuts that strained food pantries and libraries and arts venues. What are some other major news stories that you're especially proud of?
You know, I think the one thing that I'm most proud of is how many town board, planning board, and zoning board meetings that we covered. So, yeah. Like, looking at the coverage, it's like I think what we do best is, like we said, that hyper-local coverage that is just putting reporters in these town meetings to make sure that decisions aren't getting made in the dark. But then also investigations. Like, I wrote an investigative piece that took me 6 months to report about a blighted property and, a landlord and tenant situation where people were evicted, and it was just a really, really sad affordable housing story in the town of Woodstock that has become so unaffordable, as so much of the country has, into 2026. So things like that, I'm particularly proud of. The stories that require FOIL requests and deep data journalism, and we're so excited to be reporting more on this. I think another thing that we do really well is like the in-depth cultural profiles.
Yeah.
I wrote a story about Sam Sussman, who wrote, we talked about this on the radio. He claims that Bob Dylan is his father and wrote a book about this. That did really well on the site. Jim's stories were getting a lot of engagement about the Catskill weddings boom and how Shandaken and other Catskill towns are in this back and forth fight over wanting to preserve that bucolic nature of their towns versus developers coming into these towns and realizing that they can put wedding venues and things like that. So that's something that we're going to be looking into in 2026 as well.
You also broke some major news, specifically about the prolonged potable water outage in Boyceville. I don't think that if you had reported that folks would have known about it. And then also talk about the impact that had at the county level.
Yeah, I mean, people in Boyceville didn't know about it. Specifically about 100 people. Jim started reporting it, and then the county executive's office reads our newsletter, and they were alerted to this, and it triggered Jen Metzger, Ulster County Executive, to write a letter to the state legislator and try to get some action, and it has been since fixed. So I think there's a lot of room for us to be covering more environmental stories. You know, we're situated right within the Catskill Park, and there's just a lot going on.
Yeah, so, you know, shine a light on the forces shaping everyday life in the Catskills. One of the things we picked up on as well from your reporting was how pharmacy benefit managers are squeezing independent pharmacies. You focused on your specific area, and then we spoke to some other pharmacists in the rest of the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania, and it's the same, it's happening all over. And so, again, you know, that solutions-based journalism, that impactful journalism that you're reporting has a broader impact.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, we're free for people to log in. There's no annoying pop-up or anything. So I think that is what people can do. If you subscribe, we have a Friday morning newsletter, and that's how impact really happens. The more people that get eyes on these stories, the better in terms of impact and people just being aware of what's going on.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, one of the things you're most proud of is just going to those town meetings, which, you know, aren't the sexiest things, but that's where things happen. And you're there reporting it. The overlooknews.com is where you can find Overlook information and sign up for that newsletter Noah was speaking about. As you approach your 1 year anniversary coming up in a couple of months in February and moving into the new year, what are you looking forward to?
Oh my goodness! Well, there needs to be a party, so I hope that happens.
Yes.
What I'm looking forward to: more coverage, just doing more of what we're doing, getting more people, more photographers. I know we want to start implementing video. Everybody talks about this vertical video, which listeners will know as like the influencers on Instagram who are talking about news. And as much as I wince when I hear that, I think it is important for news outlets to start engaging with younger audiences. You know, most of the people that read our work at the Overlook are 30 plus. There's a whole demographic of kids in the high school and younger people that live in the Catskills that we want to be engaging with local journalism. And also we're going to be going into the schools to talk about media literacy and how to combat misinformation in this age of AI, when you're not able to tell what is what on social media. So there's a lot of stuff like that. We're hoping to just do more investigative stuff, more spot coverage of news locally, and more profiles of the interesting people that live in town.
Well,
and we're doing an events calendar, so there's a lot going on.
Oh, good. Well, we're here for it all, and we're so glad to be partners with you, and we'll be hearing more from you throughout the new year. Congratulations on this year. I'll say early anniversary congratulations as well, but we'll definitely have you back. You can go to theoverlooknews.com again. I encourage you to sign up for that newsletter to see the great reporting that Noah and the team are doing there. Even if you don't live in that area, there's things happening that you should know about, and you guys are doing great work, so we really appreciate it. Noah Exting, Editor-in-Chief of The Overlook. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays. We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call. Tom Candela is here. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Graham Plattner, the controversial candidate for a Senate seat in Maine.
As uncomfortable as it is to have to talk about stupid things I said on the internet 13 years ago, it also allows me to publicly model something I think is really important, which is that you can change your language, change the way you talk. You can think about the world in a different way.
Graham Plattner, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, our theater podcast is Curtain Call, and here is the man behind the curtain. It's Tom Candela. Tom, hi.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Good. How are you?
It's a cold day. It's cold, cold rainy day.
It's going to be like temperatures dropping down to 25 or something.
Oof.
In the meantime, we can enjoy the pleasant warmness of the latest episode of Curtain Call. Who do you have on the latest episode, which drops today?
My guests this week are Joanna Sherman and Michael McGuigan. They are two of the creatives of Bond Street Theater, a company out of New York City. Now, this company has spent nearly 50 years bringing the arts and theater into refugee camps, post-conflict regions, and communities rebuilding after trauma in more than 40 different countries, such as Afghanistan, Kosovo, Haiti, Myanmar, I think that's how some people pronounce it. Places you and I probably wouldn't go.
Not going.
They go, and they do. They bring their theater to kind of bring the communities together and help heal through theater and make transformative changes in those communities.
So we've got a preview of a portion of the conversation, but we want to remind folks that the full episode drops today
yep.
at WJFFradio.org.
Yes.
But listen to Tom talking to the folks at Bond Street Theater right now for a preview. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Joanna, Michael, I want to welcome both of you to Curtain Call.
Thank you so much. Be here. A pleasure. Yeah.
What inspired the company's mission to use theater as a tool for peace and human rights?
Right. We were founded on this idea of marrying the social, political to something that was attractive and effective and interesting for people to watch. So we were a political street theater company in the early days that were funny and had like funny characters, but were also really pointed on what was happening at that time in New York City. So that was our roots. And as we started to travel more, I think one of our epiphany moments was in 1984, we traveled to Israel and we were to create big street theater shows and it was very effective. But it was kind of that moment where we realized that people could work side by side, even though they had real different politics in their mind, and create something really beautiful. And they were actually doing something greater than themselves and created this beautiful street pageant. The theater works. It really works. It brings people together.
Michael, yeah. Were you in on it from the beginning?
I think the companies said started in 76. I joined in 1979.
Okay.
The reason I got drawn to the company at all was I had saw them performing a fairly traditional Commedia dell'arte piece up at a Renaissance festival in Sterling Forest. And I looked up the address and gave them a call, and the rest is history.
Joanna, when you first began this work, did you imagine that it would take you eventually to countries around the world?
Yeah, I think that we always had a little bit of wanderlust, but it was during the Balkan Wars that we really got hooked into the idea that we could go to a place of conflict and look at how we could use the skills that we had to address a little bit different cultures and situations. So because Bond Street Theater has a relationship with the UN, we're an NGO officially associated with the UN, we contacted UNICEF, and especially during the war in Kosovo, there were just families upon family fleeing Kosovo and these refugee camps in Albania and Macedonia. And so we hooked up with UNICEF and just went there not knowing what we're going to do exactly, because we had not worked in refugee camps, especially before. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a deep dive into a new situation. You're surrounded by 500 children who don't speak your language. Just put your hands up and then on your head and then on your toes, then on your knees. Kids will follow along. Yeah. So we just did follow the leader, and we could all be tigers. We could all do like jumping up and down. We could blow up imaginary balloons, just follow the leader and kids will follow along. But the main thing is that refugee camps are boring. People don't realize that they're nothing for people to do.
Right.
So some crazy people coming in and all of a sudden entertaining the kids was a godsend. It was such a blessing. And then we ended up walking on stilts through the whole camp so that we could involve everybody. And we had a huge parade of people following us. And we just were like grasping at straws. What can we do to keep people entertained, involved, and get them out of the misery of displacement? It was really a wake-up call for us that theater can really touch people in refugee camps, shelters, prisons, schools, villages, urban centers, anywhere. We can make an impact. And why? It's because we can. You can make a play about anything, and it's a great way to get practical information to the public. Yeah. So that's number one. And storytelling is intrinsic to human nature. So it's how we work out problems. And then two, theater training improves communication skills, body language, poise, clarity. It helps people. It prepares people to speak out on their own behalf. Right. So it's very valuable, the training itself.
Now, that took some courage to go to a war-torn area, even though it's in a refugee camp. You might have been a little safer there, but there's still some question of safety and those kind of concerns. How did you deal with that?
One of the things that UNICEF did in that situation was we would meet with at their city office, and then they'd say, okay, if you're going out to that camp, take this road. But even in Afghanistan and other countries, especially if you're working with a local theater group, mm-hmm. we know that they want to stay out of trouble.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things is we don't go anywhere with an agenda. We come in with an open mind, and it's all about listening. What do they need? What do they want to talk about? Mm-hmm. We just are there to listen and then help them in whatever way we can to create a show that to help them speak out about whatever it is that they want to speak about.
Are you coming with a scripted piece, or are you just going out there and saying, well, let's just see what happens?
We're not going with a scripted piece, that's for sure. But we are going with some extensive research on what is going on so that we have an idea. And then we always learn when we're there, too, because not everything is printed in the books and articles. We learn much more from the people that we're working with on the ground, whether it's the partners or the people that the partners work with. It's a very in-depth research because we're giving them a platform for them to act out or speak about it in a way that's safe and comfortable for them.
Right. So, Mike, I'll put this question to you. So, because Joanna's just mentioned how you don't go in there with an agenda. But yeah. Certainly, in some cases, if you're giving them a voice, mm-hmm. they have an agenda. How do you balance then their agenda with perhaps some of the political repercussions that could occur from the government per se?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's rare if they are going to take the chance to speak out against the government very forwardly, mm-hmm. because I'll give you the example of our friends in Myanmar. Tukumo Kahite is the group that we worked with there. The name of the group translates to art travelers. So they tour all over Myanmar doing shows. And two of the company members actually spent 5 to 7 years in jail when they had been involved in protests on their college campuses. So they had no interest in going back to jail. At the same time, they were very curious as to where the boundaries were. The first time we were there, we put together a children's show about hand washing, actually. They felt that would be the safest thing. Let's do something about health. But what was interesting about the hand washing show, I talked to one of the kids after the show. And they said, I liked your show. It was very funny. But, you know we have to wash hands. Problem is, in this school, we don't have running water. We don't have soap. I think you have to do a show to the adults and tell them to supply us with these things. I'm like,
that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And that is part of your mission, promoting peace and human rights and mutual understanding, using theater as a tool to achieve that. Did you find that philosophy plays out very well in these communities?
Yes. I think that people are looking for a way to have a voice. We spent 16 years working in Afghanistan off and on all different kinds of programs. And it was definitely a learning experience to do a deep dive into another culture.
Okay.
We did a little tour where we would do a show, just kind of an entertaining show, and then a workshop afterwards in juggling, stilt walking, and the sounds of, well, stilt walking, why stilt walking? You put a kid on stilts and they feel like $1 million. It's uplifting viscerally, physically, mentally. They're taller than their father. They're taller than their teacher. It just is so uplifting. It's really empowering.
Given today's environment, is there something that you see now that Bond Street Theater and your efforts can do at this point in time, either in the Middle East or any other conflict that we see going on in other parts of the world, Ukraine, for instance?
Yes, we actually just had a meeting yesterday with our partner who's Ukrainian, and we're proposing to work with Ukrainian refugees in Poland, or perhaps bringing groups of people from Eastern Europe, groups of actors, artists, people that are doing this kind of work similar to ours, bringing us together in one of these locations, a safe location, where we can exchange experiences and we can exchange methodologies.
Michael, where are you in the process? Is it just the beginning of the idea, or are we actually reaching out to these communities as we speak?
Yeah, we're reaching out to them. But, you know, one of our strategies has always been we start in any of the places we've been in. The first 3 days is just we call them theater games, but they're really just games, playing, stuff that doesn't have winners and losers, but basically gets people laughing and singing and mm-hmm. showing each other dances. Once you've done that, once we've all laughed with each other, then we sit down and go, okay, what's the topic we want to talk about? And that's when the metal hits the road and people come out with their views. But they've already laughed with each other.
Right.
So it makes it easier to communicate in a more less conflict way than one normally would have thought under the circumstances. Yeah. So I'm figuring I'm a proponent for, like, I think we need to do some of this work here in our own country with the same attitude, not to go in to tell anybody what we think is happening, but mm-hmm. Well, what are you guys thinking? This has been our experience. What's your experience? And right. Take it from there.
If there's a group out there that would like to collaborate with us, then they should certainly get in touch with us. They can get our email, which is info@bondstreet.org. So BONDST.org. So it's like Bond Street, but abbreviate street.
Okay.
info@BONDST.org. Or they can go to our website, which is BONDST.org. And see what else we do and how we might be invited to do a talk about this kind of work to right. their group or their church group or their temple or mosque or whatever.
I've been to your website and it's very easy to navigate through it and to introduce yourself or learn about each one of the people who are involved in Bond Street Theater. And there's plenty of yep. links that going directly to the productions and learn a lot more about their programs and how they have really affected and contributed to our world. It's a beautiful thing.
We'd love to hear from them. They should just feel free to write to us. We're very personable people, and we love to talk to people.
And that is a clip from the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast. The full episode and all of the previous episodes are available at wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, this Sunday's winter solstice will be marked with an intimate afternoon of acoustic music. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi tells us more next. This is Radio Chatskill.
For 45 years, the male vocal ensemble Chanticleer has been one of the shining stars of the choral firmament. To help us celebrate this holiday season, Chanticleer comes to share music from the time of the English Renaissance to today. Join us for a special hour of incredible musical harmony with Chanticleer.
Sunday night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm David Christian, host of Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9 here on Radio Catskill. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting local public radio, where your necessary local and national news coverage mixes with a wide range of music handpicked for you by members of your community, and not by algorithms. So from all of us at Radio Catskill, we wish you a safe and festive holiday season, and a happy new year.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This Sunday marks the winter solstice, and in Rosendale, it will be celebrated with an afternoon of intimate acoustic music. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with acclaimed finger-picking guitarist and singer-songwriter Hiroya Sakamoto ahead of the winter solstice matinee. It's Sunday at 2:30 at The Muse.
Hi, and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I see here that you do a finger-picking style of playing the guitar?
Yes, that's what I mostly do. Like, so without using a pick, I use mostly right-hand fingers to pluck strings.
What is the difference in the kind of sound that you're able to get?
So with the fingers, basically, I can use four independent fingers. I can do a little more complicated and intricate stuff.
Because you're not holding a pick?
Right. So I can do like separate, more things basically. More sound, more like little details.
Tell us a little bit about what you're planning for the concert as it relates to the winter solstice.
Okay, so I'm a solo performer, and which I do is playing acoustic guitar, but I also sing and storytelling. So it is a combination of those different things. And I engage audience with some stories behind the songs. So that's what I'm planning to do for this show on 21st in Rosendale.
Now, have you played in Rosendale before?
Yes, I played there two times. One in the cave, like what is it called, a widow.
Oh yes, the cave, right?
Cave.
Yes.
Yeah. It was beautiful. And then I also played the same venue, the Muse, earlier this year, and it was a beautiful, intimate space. So I decided to come back there.
When it was in the cave, what was the sound like?
Sound was very unique because, you know, you can imagine the acoustics were very active, right?
Of course.
Lots of the echoes. I mean, sometimes it's good, but sometimes, you know, a little much, too much. You know, so because I cannot adjust the amount, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's going to be beautiful for especially like a cappella singers or something like that.
You have a music group called Interoceanico?
Yeah, I did. That's what my group. Not so much anymore. So I mostly do a solo or smaller settings now.
And do you incorporate music from all over the world?
I used to do that because that band had so many performers from different countries. So I all the time get inspirations from, you know, the music they taught me. But now I do solo, so I don't, you know, intend to, like, incorporate this and this. And I just try to just, you know, compose good music, good melodies. And, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do right now.
So you compose your own music.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about yourself or the event before we conclude?
Yeah, so this year I performed a lot of shows all across the United States. And then I played at around like 120 shows this year. And this will be my last show in this year. So I try my best to, you know, offer what I can do for this show. So I hope people can come.
And so you'll have a little bit of time to rest before you get ready for next year.
Yeah. The first show is January 2nd. So I have about a week.
And where is that?
It's going to be Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
The Northeast.
It was wonderful talking to you, and have a wonderful winter solstice event.
Thank you very much.
And that solstice event is the Winter Solstice Matinee, Sunday at 2:30 at the Muse in Rosendale. More information at themuserosendale.org. And a bit of holiday cheer before we sign off for the weekend. The Minnesink Treble Choir was at the Sullivan County Government Center in Monticello yesterday, singing classical and modern holiday songs in the lobby. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar was there and captured some of the magic.
The lights are turned way.
the Mid-State Choir at the Government Center. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Donna Fellenberg here from Catskill Character. You know, Christmas is coming. This Saturday is the seventh day of Hanukkah, and Sunday is the first day of winter. My guests this week, Doug Wirth and Joanna Breitstein, bring two different approaches to the holidays and one common message. Join us Saturday at 10:30 on Catskill Character and hear their message right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, windy conditions and rain today mixed with a possible snow shower in spots this afternoon. The high will peak at about 53 and then drop down to 23 for this evening. Very windy, colder for the weekend as well. 32 for a high Saturday, 35 for a high Sunday. Both days partly sunny and breezy. Monday, high 27. On Point is next.